I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep us stuck. Smashing the Plateau is part of the Best Network, dedicated to supporting individual entrepreneurs who are experts in their field, but may not be an expert at running a business. Best Network is ideal if you are an expertise-driven solopreneur business owner with many years of experience in your field. If you are a consultant, coach, or professional selling your knowledge and creativity, we're here for you. If you join the Best Network, you'll receive access to the full Smashing the Plateau archive of over 350 episodes, and you'll receive expert, individual, and team mentorship, peer support, and curated educational content that reinforces and expands our goal of the show, helping you get your business the recurring revenue it deserves. With teams of like-minded and supportive professionals surrounding you, you'll be perfectly poised to smash the plateau in your business with our programs. To learn more about joining the Best Network and how to smash your plateau, go to smashingtheplateau.com/bestnetwork. That's smashingtheplateau.com/bestnetwork. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Tom Poland. Tom started his first business at age 24 and has gone on to start and sell four others, taking two of them international. In that time, he's managed teams of over 100 people and annual revenue of more than $20 million. He's the best-selling author of Leadsology, The Science of Being in Demand. He's also shared international speaking platforms with the likes of Michael Gerber of eMyth fame, Richard Koch from the 80-20 Principle, Brian Tracy, and many others. Tom, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, David. It's a real privilege to be here.
And I'm grateful for you taking the time to work this out with me in terms of time zone, since you're in Australia and I am in America.
Yes, one of the interesting and fascinating things about working globally via the internet is you end up talking to a very interesting thing at strange times of the morning.
Yes, you do. So, Tom, having started and sold four businesses, what made you decide to become an entrepreneur in the first place?
You know, there was a defining moment, and I was working in a corporate as an exec, reasonably senior, and my job involved a bit of traveling. And I was driving from one office to the other and our national network. And, you know, I was a tapeaholic. Back in those days, we didn't have MP3s. Hell, we didn't even have CDs. We had cassette tapes, you know, 8 drives and so on. And it was like a mobile education library. I'm sure a lot of people do this today with podcasts. And I was driving along, and the speaker quoted Mark Twain. And Mark Twain said, "Time is the stuff of which life is made." And I literally pulled my car over because it hit me like, I don't know, a plank between the eyeballs. Just smacked me. And I thought, my God, I don't have control of my life, because I didn't have control of my time. I was working in someone else's businesses. Well, actually, it was an international business. And I had applied for leave on 5 occasions in the previous 12 months and been declined because things were happening and I was too senior and too important and took on everything else. And that's really the moment. That's the moment that started me on the path of getting back to being an entrepreneur, because I had been an entrepreneur. So that was the primary motivation, is I didn't want to finish my life and retire with a gold watch and look back and think, crap, I didn't actually live my life. I lived the life of the corporate.
So you went from an entrepreneur to being in corporate and then being an entrepreneur again.
I did. I got an offer to go into a management position, and I had several of my own businesses. In fact, I had two of my own businesses at the time of that offer. And it was a pretty good deal, you know. And the one thing I was very interested in was professional development. And what came along with the offer, in addition to all sorts of fat paychecks and retirement funding and, you know, you name it, it was there, luxury automobiles and so on, was professional development of a global best practice, ongoing year after year professional development. And that was very appealing to me. So I did exactly the opposite of what a lot of people did, is I jumped from having my own businesses. I packed them up and sold them off and got into corporate life. And I have to say, thoroughly enjoyed it up until the point where I heard
the wake-up call.
That quote from Mark Twain. Yeah. And the first thing I did is I then went and looked in bookstores, and I found a book called Jumping the Job Track. which was all about going from being what effectively was a senior management into starting your own business again. And that's what I did.
And what was the first business that you started after you left corporate?
First business I started was a three-year curriculum-based education program for business owners, because back then in 1995, we had the MBA, and that was good for corporate people. And we had institutes of management who would run, you know, Thursday courses or Wednesday night courses or whatever they were. But there was no ongoing, longer-term development program for business owners that showed them things like, simple things like strategic planning, KPIs, how to hire people, how to performance appraise people. So I wanted to develop this nitty-gritty, practical, step-by-step process. So we met with clients meeting in groups one day every 90 days over a three-year period. And then we had an alumni or graduate program. And we took them through everything of A to Z of business, but also their personal life, because I wanted to have that impact on, I wanted to make sure we weren't just producing one-sided entrepreneurs. It was actually called the Entrepreneur's Success Program, or ESP program as it came to be known. So we started by teaching them goal setting, not just in terms of their business, but also their personal life, their health, their relationships, and their personal finances. And we started with simple things like, you know, goal setting, how much money do you want out of the business and financial independence. But by the time the 3 years were over, we were having them meditating and changing their diet and all sorts of things. So tremendously satisfying, holistic program, which I, you know, was so successful, I was fortunate enough to be able to license that internationally.
And why was that the kind of business that you started? What intrigued you about that, this idea?
I think I could trace the thread back to that exact same thought that I pictured myself sitting on a rocking chair, you know, aged 90 years old, looking back on my life. And the big decision, I suppose, was did I have the courage to make this the sort of program that I felt I should make it? In other words, to include the personal aspects of life, because it might be a lot more commonplace now, but back in 1995, there was no one doing it. There was no one, there were no forerunners saying, you know, like, this is a good idea, this is a well-trodden path. This was, we were saying to people, look, if you join this program, we're going to help you grow your business, but we're also going to focus on developing your personal life. We're going to teach you things like relationships, happiness, freedom, love, how to be a great mom or dad, how to be a great husband or wife, how to make a contribution to community. So it wasn't something that people were talking about. Yes, there was the odd, you know, personal development guru, but no one was combining both of them. So it really came back to the sense of purpose and the sense of contribution. And secondary to that, I have to say it was still very, very important, was commercial imperative to make money out of the darn thing. And now that I know what I know about marketing, it was an accidentally perfect plan. There's some contradiction of saying it was an accidental plan, but really I didn't know that that was the thing to do, to create what I call a black jelly bean, a product which was so differentiated that people either like it or they hate it. I love it or they hate it, but that's what I did. And it really just hit the sweet spot in the market. And it really was a remarkably, looking back, a remarkably easy program to market because it was so highly differentiated. And I guess there's a clue to that for our listeners that if they're going to go into the market with their own business, the trick is, as Coco Chanel said, you know, in order to be indispensable, one must be different.
So let's talk about that, because the world of entrepreneurship has changed in the way perhaps that it's viewed or what is taught to entrepreneurs 20 plus years later. And in fact, nowadays, the world of work has changed a lot, and there are many more people that are entrepreneurs either by design or by circumstance, especially people in the consulting world. Mm. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how some of the principles that you started teaching 20 plus years ago might be really great for people that are running essentially single person businesses today based on deep knowledge in a particular field or creative area. What is it that can differentiate them, set them apart, and take this deep reservoir of expertise that they've built up over many years and build some financial success around it?
Great question. And it really gets to the whole starting point of marketing services, which is differentiation. And just a quick metaphor for the listeners. So imagine you've written a book and it's really the best book in the world, if not literally, then pretty close to it. And you've got your book on this in this bookstore, and it's a massive bookshelf. There's lots and lots and lots of books, but yours is one of them. And it's sitting there, and you're looking at this massive bookshelf with 200 books or more in it. And you can see yours in the middle there, and you think, great, I've made it. My book is on the bookshelf. And someone comes along and looks at the bookshelf, and the whole book is filled up with the same subject that you're talking about. But you know yours is the best one. It's been voted top book in the world or whatever. And you just study the person, and they're looking at the bookshelf, and you can see their eyes running over the rows, and you're thinking, my book's the best one there. Pick my book. Go on, pick my book. You don't want to say anything because you don't want to be rude. And they never pick your book. And they just look at it, and they pick a couple of other books, and they go away to the counter and buy someone else's books. And you think, my goodness, what a great shame. You know, my book was the best book there. Why aren't people buying my book? And then you take one step back, and you notice that all the covers look the same. And even though the content of your book is unique and it's valuable, there's nothing on the outside of that book to distinguish your book from everyone else's book. So it ain't selling. And the book, of course, is a metaphor for your business card, for your conversations, for your LinkedIn profile, for your website. If someone went to your website, would they instantly and immediately see something or hear something or both that is differentiated? Now, how do you start with that? Well, the best place to start is to recognize inside your own mind that what you have is unique and it is differentiated. And very likely it's transformational. In other words, to start backing yourself and to realize that because of the unique set of your own circumstances, what you have to offer is unique. It's as unique as your DNA, as your eye print, as your fingerprint. So to that end, to make this differentiation transform from being invisible to the marketplace to being something which is highly visible, you need to come up with a name for what it is that you do and register that as a proprietary trademark. And if you look at some of the biggest brands in the world, they have literally all done this. You know, Coca-Cola's a registered trademark. So let's reflect and take an example from the real life world. So when I started my current business, it's all around lead generation. Now, there's around about 1 million people in the world that will offer you lead generation services. And if you go to the websites, they'll talk about business growth, and they'll talk about marketing, they'll talk about marketing systems and so on. So that's kind of like if I were to start positioning myself as a marketing trainer or something like that, it's kind of like having the same book cover as everyone else. But in fact, I've got stuff that's highly differentiated. So I came up with a name that didn't exist before, Leadsology, and I registered that as a trademark in most English-speaking countries around the world. You probably only need to start in your own country, wherever you're listening to this from. But immediately, when someone goes to the LinkedIn profile, if I had a business card, it would be on there. to the website, they see Leadsology, the science of being demand. It's a registered trademark. So there's an immediate point of differentiation. I don't talk about marketing very much at all. It's all about Leadsology. Second step is to have a look at the process of value delivery. How do you deliver the value? What has to happen in the experience of a customer when they work with you? Probably there's an initial diagnosis of some description. Then you probably come back with some sort of, if you do it the way I'd recommend, you come back with some sort of draft plan, implementation plan. You get the client input into that. And you go to the third level, which is possibly it's starting to brief the people within that organization you're going to be working with and so on. So there'll be a series of steps that you go through, 5 steps, 3 steps, 10 steps. I don't know what it is. But what you do is you then create a model out of that. And if people want to an example of that, they can go to Leadsology. Guru, and they can go to the free stuff page, and they'll see there's one of the options there is to download our model. And because one of a great lead generator, a great list builder, I should say, and there's a difference, but a great list builder is to have something that's short, simple, and shiny, the three S's for people to download from your website or click on it and go from your LinkedIn profile to that. So what this does, David, is it starts the differentiation process by having a name or a term for what you do. And I have a client in Boulder, Colorado, who is an expert at hiring the right people. So she came up with Hirometry. I have a merchant integration acquisition consultant in London who came up with the term techquisition because he's all about acquiring tech companies. So techquisition, registered trademark. So you come up with this word, and then you create this model, this proprietary model, which drives home in the mind of the prospects and in your marketplace the differentiation to a much, much deeper level. So if you want to acquire a tech company and you've experienced Paul's brand, the merger and acquisition specialist of technology companies in London, and you like his stuff and you like his methodology and you've downloaded his model and you can see it makes sense and you can see why it would be so effective, there is only one place in the whole world that you can get techquisition from, and that's Paul's company. Whereas you can get M&A stuff from a gazillion different companies.
These are great examples. And Tom, once you've created your differentiation, are there steps that you've taken in your business and that you recommend other people take in order to produce recurring revenue to support the system that it is you're selling?
Right. Well, maybe just I'll first of all comment on the concept of recurring revenue. And I suppose like anything else, there's a spectrum. So one end of the spectrum is the idea that, which I'm pretty sure very few of your listeners would have bought into, is that it's like, you can work for 2.5 hours a week and you can sit on the beach with your laptop for half an hour because you've got some sort of membership website and money just keeps flowing, washing over your beautiful body as you sit there on the beach with your laptop for half an hour a day. And that concept of recurring revenue, I will build this thing and people will keep paying money for this thing while I can go and do what I really want to do. That concept doesn't work. That concept was really good for selling books that promote the concept, but other than that, it really doesn't work. The moment you stop developing however you deliver the value, and the moment you stop marketing, you're dead. That's it. So that's one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum is the concept of recurring revenue where you continue to deliver value, albeit it might be in a scalable manner, more scalable manner, or more leveraged manner through one-to-many or through online programs or through pricing. Pricing is a good way to scale if you're a consultant and you really want to keep getting your hands into the weeds, so to speak. That can be a relevant and appropriate mechanism. So my take on recurring revenue is this. By all means, I'll charge a client perhaps a 12-month recurring fee. So that sets up a 12-month flow of fee and you get a number of clients doing that. That's really nice. It could be $25,000 a month, or it could be less, or it could be more. But so the idea of the monthly recurring fee, it is a cool one. And if it's a staged proposal, so stage one, the client pays X, stage two, they pay Y, page three, it's still like a recurring income. Now, so if we accept that that's my version of recurring revenue, where we're onboarding new clients and we're building up the recurring revenue to a point where we can service the clients, et cetera, then recurring revenue continues to recur and it continues to build by doing some form of what is called direct response marketing virtually every single week of the year. So it's input and outcome, isn't it? If you have a pipe and you keep sticking stuff in the front end of the pipe, eventually it comes out the other end of the pipe. So I'm not sure if that's quite what was meant by recurring revenue, but my idea of recurring revenue certainly is to bill clients monthly, to give them that option, which 80% of them take, and to keep putting the clients in.
For those that may not be familiar with direct response marketing, can you define it?
Thank you. Omission for my part. So if you think of the three things that I recommend that listeners set a KPI for, a goal for, the first is to build their email subscriber list every single week. The second is to nurture that list with quality content every single week via social media, via podcasts, blogs, whatever it might be. And the third is to have some form of direct response or call to action style marketing. So that every single week, there is a group of people somewhere on the planet who are presented with the opportunity to book a time to speak with you. So in the world of consultants and executive coaches and corporate trainers, which are my three main client categories, every single inquiry should come through what we might call a strategy consult or a discovery call with you as the potential supplier. And so my KPI is that every single week you present someone with that value proposition. You say to a group of people or a small group of people, here is the link to book a time to talk with me about becoming a client. Now, that's what I mean by a call to, that's a very specific example of direct response marketing or call to action marketing. Now, clearly something significant has to have happened prior to presenting someone with the opportunity to talk with you. And that significant something is what I call a persuasion sequence. So there needs to be, when we're marketing services, it's far more like proposing marriage than it is selling a car. you know, we are suggesting that someone enter into our relationship with us, very often a medium to long-term relationship with us. So they need to have all sorts of questions answered in their mind prior to accepting our proposal, so to speak. So that's what a call to action marketing is, or direct response marketing is. Same deal. Group of people presented with the opportunity to speak with you, and they know your fee range, and they have a pretty good idea of how you work with clients. And the third thing is that they're very, very confident that you can solve their solution. So the bit that comes before that call to action, that's probably a webinar or a video conference or a boardroom briefing or a lunch and learn, or they've read your book. But it's some form of marketing asset which you've developed, which walks people through what I call that persuasion sequence, which starts with why you should listen to me, what the problem is that I solve, what the symptoms of that problem are, and it goes on through a significant period of time, I would say at least 40 minutes of reading or of watching a webinar or a videos, where they get to the point where they go, I need to talk to this person. I need to talk with David. I need to talk with Tom. Where's the link? And they book a time to talk with you.
Sounds very logical and not necessarily so simple for a lot of people to do.
That's correct. It's one of the, well, it's.
No, seriously.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think it's really worth underlying that it's not that easy to do. Because unless you're a professional marketer and you know the psychology behind buying, it's really like pin the tail on the donkey. Gee, I hope I hit the mark, you know. But there is, when you have this explained to you, for example, it makes total sense when you have it explained to you. But before you have it explained to you, very often people go, what the heck do I do? I mean, how do I get people to a webinar, for example? What do I say when they arrive? How do I walk them through an experience which would, firstly, and very most importantly, be valuable so they associate value with my brand, but secondly, would cut through what all my competitors are saying and would lead them to a point where they emotionally and logically feel that they would like to talk to me about becoming a client? How do I do that? Because that seems like a bit of a magic act, right?
Right. And if you do it well, price is not necessarily part of the discussion.
Look, provided they can find the money, then price is not saying price is only ever an issue and value is a mystery. Sometimes it can be an issue if people don't know, if they haven't had the answer to the question, you can put air quotes around this. So how does it all work? Because that is a very common question. When people see your value proposition and you've got cut through, you know, your marketing message, mine is, you know, enjoy a weekly flow of high quality inbound new client inquiries. That's my marketing message. When people see that and think, wow, yeah, I'd like a flow of high quality inbound new client inquiries coming to my business every week. When they see that, what they begin to look at, they check the price out perhaps, but then their mind immediately goes to other options. Immediately. It's like, I like that. Gee, I wonder if I could do it myself. I wonder if I could just buy the book and put it in place. I wonder if there's someone else who could do this faster, simpler, in a less expensive manner. And so that's what our mind does. It searches for alternatives. So whatever experience that we invite our prospects to consume, webinars, books, et cetera, it's about 17 different options, it's got to answer those questions. And the way I describe it to people is you imagine a 100-meter track and you put your pot of gold over the finish line. That pot of gold represents your unique sales proposition or marketing message, whatever it happens to be. And there's a prospect at the start line. And you can see the prospect looking at the pot of gold. And you're thinking, why don't they run to the pot of gold? I've just put it over the finish line there. It's not hard. It's a straight line. It's flat. But what the prospect sees is they see hurdles between them and the pot of gold. They see pricing issues. They see risk issues. Can I trust this person? Am I going to be able to implement what they recommend? Because we've hired people like this before and we haven't implemented and we've been left with nothing other than a slightly emptier bank account. And so they see all these hurdles between them and the pot of gold. And those hurdles, we have to make them disappear when that person reads our book or comes to our webinar or views our video series, whatever it is. And the other thing they see is they see detours off the 100-meter track to direct competitors, indirect competitors, and do it yourself or do it in-house. So all of those have to be disappeared. So the person now sees what you and I thought they initially saw, which was simply our irresistible value proposition. So I agree 100%. I mean, you know, I'm describing this strategically or in big picture terms. This is what has to happen. And I think you quite rightly said, well, that kind of makes sense, but gee, it doesn't sound that easy. And it's kind of like, when I was a kid, I used to enjoy Sherlock Holmes books, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle. And I'll never forget. I can't have been more than 10 when I was reading this. And I'll never forget this, one of the openings of the book. And Holmes is standing at the window looking out into the street. And Watson, his assistant, comes over. And Watson looks out the window and sees some disheveled looking man walking along the street. And Watson says something like, gosh, that fellow looks like he's seen better days. And Holmes immediately says, yes, well, he was serving as a sub-lieutenant in the Indian Regiment between 94 and 96. And he joined such and such a club, and then his wife left him, and then blah, 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 blah. So it's no wonder he's down on his luck. And Watson turns to Holmes and says, you can't possibly tell that from just looking at the man for 60 seconds. And Holmes then proceeds to describe what's left of the man's uniform, the button on his lapel, which indicated the campaigns he served in. And he goes on for about, you know, 2 or 3 minutes describing exactly how and why he knows why this person is who he is. So he finishes explaining. Then Watson looks at Holmes and says, well, now that you've explained it, it's perfectly obvious. And marketing's a bit like that.
It sure is.
Yeah, once you get on the inside, you go, well, that makes sense. But I didn't see that it made sense until I got on the inside, until Sherlock Holmes explained it to me.
Well, with that in mind, Tom, let's talk about somebody you know personally who has done a remarkable job at smashing plateaus.
Right. Well, I'm going to introduce you to Thomas Kessler, who was a PwC consultant and partner, worked across Europe and North America, is now a resident in Bonn, Germany. And Thomas is a perfect example of someone who smashed the plateau. He got made redundant from PwC, not because he wasn't any good, just because they were doing one of these political annual restructures, and moved back to his hometown in Bonn, Germany, and had nothing. You know, he was used to working as a PwC partner, and it's a lot of prestige and status, not to mention the money that comes back with that. And then that's one day, and not literally the next, but almost the next day, he's sitting on his bum in his office at home, staring at a screen going, what the do I do? And I admire him greatly because he's got off his bum and he studied and he figured out what to do to get new clients in, and he marketed the heck out of himself. And the number one rule people say to me, gee, you mentioned like there's 17 different things I could be doing for marketing. What's the most important thing? And my response is always the same. Do some marketing. And Thomas is a great example of that because well before we worked together, he did some. He got out there, and with whatever tools he had at his disposal, he started doing some marketing. And he learned, because he invested in pieces of courses and programs and hired people, he learned what it took to get new clients on board. Now he literally is flying around the world, actually a little bit more than he wants to, I suppose, and he's in demand. But it started with this initial recognition, perhaps born out of necessity, but this initial recognition that his primary purpose in his business was not to work with clients, but it was to find the clients to work with. Because unless he became a master of marketing, there weren't any clients to work with. And even if there were, it tended to be roller coaster revenue. You know, you're flat out busy with clients 1 month, the next month there's not a lot happening. So that would be my cameo for you. My role model I'd recommend for you is Thomas Kessler in Bonn, Germany.
What a great example. And Tom, what can we look forward to in the near future from you? What's coming up?
Look, I've got a new book coming out in the Leadsology series. The first one was Leadsology, the Science of Being in Demand, which was a bestseller, I'm delighted to say. And because a couple of my previous books were, I mentioned to you before, David, they were very good at propping up the screen to get it to eye level, but they didn't do a whole lot more than that. So Leadsology, the Science of Being in Demand, I'm following that up with another book called Leadsology, Marketing the Invisible. We've decided also to run monthly webinars for folks who are interested in the subject of lead generation. So that's a little bit of what's on the horizon coming out from Leadsology.
How can listeners learn more about you and follow you?
Best thing to do is if people want more leads and they want to learn a little bit about lead generation and marketing, what it takes, they can go to 5hourchallenge.com. That's the word 5hourchallenge.com. There's a completely free program there. It's very simple. It's 10 minutes videos a day over 5 days. You devote 1 hour in entirety, including watching the video plus completing the action items. And the objective is to generate 5 fresh leads over those 5 days. So that's a good place to start. It's completely free, 5hourchallenge.com. They can also go to www.gettomsbook.com or just go to our main website, leadsology.guru. There's a bunch of free stuff there that we can help people with.
Sounds great. Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Chief Leedsologist Tom Poland. Thank you again, Tom, for joining us.
Thanks, David. It has been a privilege.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, part of the Best Network, dedicated to supporting individual entrepreneurs who are experts in their field, but may not be an expert at running a business. If you're a solopreneur who's an expert in your field, but not necessarily smashing your plateau in business, and you want to ramp your recurring revenue, join our Best Network. Receive expert individual and team mentorship, peer support, and curated educational content that reinforces and expands on our goal of the show, helping you get your business the recurring revenue it deserves. To learn more about joining the Best Network, go to smashingtheplateau.com/bestnetwork. That's smashingtheplateau.com/bestnetwork. Join us and smash your plateau.